Welcome to the Casey Kowar Show, a celebration of words. We're talking today with Lawley Winston, the author of Good Grief, published by Warner Books, available in trade paperback. And Lawley, with the book clubs around the country that you've been talking to and the readings you've been doing, what is the common element that you've been finding with when we talk about, when the readers talk about Sophie Stanton, the protagonist of Good Grief, who becomes a widow at the age of 36 after only 3 years of marriage?
Well, I found it astonishing, first of all, how many young widows there are out there, and that grief is a universal experience. You know, it's big and messy and scary, and you feel, I think, more than sad. Grief makes you crazy, and I think that's why people have said, wow, I can't believe you. Just what I went through. That's just how I felt after losing each of my parents. I lost my dad when I was in my late 20s and my mother when I was in my early 30s, and it makes you crazy for a while. And I think that many people weren't widows. Maybe they had just been divorced or lost a parent, or one woman even jokingly said that, you know, even after her pot plant died, she felt that way. So, you know, I mean, it applies to people in all different kinds of ways.
You know, and grief is an odd thing. I was in my hometown today doing a radio show where I was on the other side of the microphone, and I stopped by my father's grave, which is about 100 miles from where I live. And my father's been dead for 30 years, and someone had put a marker on his grave because he was in World War II. And that simple act of kindness that someone did that moved me to tears. And you would think that after 30 years, I'm 48 years old, you would think that this concept of ever getting over grief would take over. But I've learned to trust my instincts with grief. In that moment, I just allowed myself to experience the grief of the loss of my father, even though it's been 30 years, but it felt like it happened yesterday.
Yeah, you know, soon after my father died, I went to a luncheon and there was an elderly lady there, and somehow it came up in conversation that my father had died of cancer, and her sister died when she was quite young, and she turned to me and she said, "It's never quite the same, is it?" And for some reason those words were so much more comforting to me than all the other kind of catchphrases we have for people who are grieving. It's a long life. He's in a better place now, at least he's not pain anymore. Because it isn't ever quite the same. I don't think you ever, there are some things that you don't ever get over, and that's okay.
Yeah, and I think that one thing I've learned through dealing with the grief in my own life is that people like to talk about the person who's dead. And oftentimes, whether it's a widow or the loss of a parent or a sibling or a pet or whatever it is, people tiptoe around the topic where actually what that person really wants to do is talk about the person they've lost.
Yeah, I think that can be one of the most helpful things to people to have someone warning. You know, I'm not a psychologist, obviously.
Right.
I'm an expert. But I think, you know, yeah, the sharing a fond memory that you had of that person, just talking about them a little bit. Because the sort of saddest part is that they're gone. You have photos and memories, but they're gone in that tactile way. Their clothes, their smell, and the sound of their voice. And also other people's memories may be different from their own. Nice.
Yes.
From the silver lining, in my opinion.
Yeah, and Sophie had Ethan cremated, and she kind of has second thoughts about that because she doesn't have a place to visit. She kind of questions technology, like what good is it if you can't communicate with the dead? And those are the kind of thoughts I think that a person that's going through grief actually has. And in the world today, with the technology we do have, as Sophie becomes unraveled, I think you do an excellent job of describing the deterioration she goes through as she's dealing with her grief and kind of falls apart. And you do it with pathos and humor at the same time, which is what I think which is why I think this novel has been as successful as it is.
Well, thanks. You know, I think that there's a lot of inherent absurdity in someone dying and just being gone. She has this thought. She wants to keep her husband's coat, and her mother-in-law is so hyper-practical, says, no, we can't keep the coat. You have to give it away to Goodwill. And so we think, okay, you just don't need a coat when you're dead. It's that simple. But it's hard to wrap your mind around stuff like that. You know, that sort of existential angst of death and a person being gone forever. And I think in that absurdity, there's lots of ironic humor. Never at first. I don't think, you know, I didn't see any humor, irony, or any poignancy even when my father first died and my mother. But I think, you know, a little bit later, as time goes on,
yeah, eventually you can think about some of the positive things as well as the negative things. And I think that as Sophie's character develops, one of the things I really like is that at first she has, there's a quote you have later in the book where she says, my new boyfriend has faults, but my dead husband is perfect. And we can idealize grief and think that kind of a euphoric recall about relationships we've had. And I think that's another thing about Sophie that I really liked, is, or the way you wrote about Sophie, was that as she goes through the grief, she begins to really honestly analyze the relationship she had with her husband, and it wasn't perfect.
Right. I think we tend to canonize the dead. You know, I remember one Thanksgiving, I was feeling really irritated with my family members. Painfully missed my father and wished that he was there. And then I realized, you know, if he was here, he'd probably had too many drinks and he'd be making some sort of blunder, and we might be arguing about some stupid little thing. And that's sort of the realization that Sophie had. And she didn't have a perfect marriage. And nobody does. In a way, it makes death and the loss of someone much more interesting and complicated if your relationship with them wasn't perfect.
Mm-hmm. And she wants to be a Jackie Kennedy widow, but she's more of a Jack Daniels widow.
That's right, and it's not to disparage Jackie Kennedy at all, but she's
no.
So classy. I mean, the word class sums her up. Closure, and Sophie can't muster any of that. She's kind of a disaster.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Barely holding it together. She drives through her garage door and doesn't pay her bills on time. She kind of falls apart.
Yeah, and there's also, I thought you wrote with very great compassion about the topic of fertility. And the when people are asking her if she's going to have children, and there was a line in there, I'm paraphrasing, but that their sex life had seemed like work. And in addition to grief, I think one of the things that struck a chord with me, not having my own children, being a step-parent, is that a lot of times people ask people that are married why they don't have children, and it's a very insensitive question if you ask me.
It is. I think that the assumption is you don't have children because you want to stay up late and go to first-run movies and play your car stereo loud and hop on a plane to France anytime. But usually if people don't have children, there's at least a little bit more of a complicated and potentially peaceful reason why they don't. But people, for some reason, don't kind of need to ask because drink Robitussin and stop your baby in China.
Yeah.
As their neighbor did. So, and she and her husband, he and Ethan, and her husband, were unable to conceive during their short marriage. And part of the problem, of course, at first was that he wanted to put it off. And that's a very Silicon Valley mentality, especially during the boom, was that you're going to do everything later, you know, and right now just work like crazy. Later, big payoff, and during that time, many people didn't have dinner with their families, and engineers weren't home in time to put their, give their kids a bath. There was a loss of perspective there. And so we had that a little bit earlier.
Yeah. Now, part two is called Lust. And Sophie moves to Oregon and moves in with her friend Ruth. And she signs up for Big Brothers and Big Sisters. And she's matched with Crystal Lohman, a 13-year-old a pyromaniac. And to me, as you were writing this, Crystal almost takes over the novel at times. And how did you balance the fun you were having writing about Crystal, but I'm using fun with parentheses, when you began writing the novel and Crystal's personality emerged, how did you keep her in check and not let her just completely take over the novel?
Well, you know, that's sort of the thing I liked about writing Crystal. You know, when you sit down to write, you want a scene with conflict and you want something happening and not just a flat two-dimensional landscape. And the thing that I liked about Crystal is there was inherent conflict whenever she walked into the room. And she is a bit of a nightmare. And she swears, and she's a little mean-spirited and has proclivity for starting fires. But I wanted Sophie to interact with someone other than a new man. When she, in other words, she leaves town and starts over, and I didn't want it to be a dating story where she just has a variety of men that she interacts with. And, you know, in Sophie's mind, she wasn't able to have children, so she fantasizes when she joins, she becomes a big sister, she'll get a littler girl, and they'll color her together and make cookies. Instead, she gets the nightmare of a teenager, and Sophie really sort of has to come out of her shell a bit and deal with this teenage girl and try and help her, and they end up helping each other.
And one of the lines you had, I'm a step parent, and my wife, I have a wonderful stepdaughter who's now 21, and one of the lines you have in the chapter Thanksgiving, you said, "I think I know how the mother of a teenage daughter must feel, like an indispensable annoyance."
Right.
And when I read that line, I put the book, I reread the book this week because I read it when that came out in hardcover, and I laughed out loud when I read that line because, and I'll repeat that for the readers, "I think I know how the mother of a teenage daughter must feel, like an indispensable annoyance." That is good writing.
Right, well, thanks. There's that moment where Sophie's trying to, you know, as when she meets Crystal, she's sort of a preteen, and over the course of their relationship, you know, it's in that year where she's becoming a teenager, and you just can't ever say the right thing. I mean, I remember being that way. I lived alone with my dad at the time. You're so annoyed by your parents or step-parents, and I think it's hard. It's a hard job being a step-parent. I'm sure it can be a painful job on many days.
Yeah, and the and you know, I think that it's a long term commitment, and in my case it's worked out beautifully, and but you cat that those two sentences are what I love about books. And another one, quote that I that caught me the second time I read the book was Sophie's getting ready to go out on a date with Drew, and I wrote this down because I didn't want to misquote it, and I think that it captures, for book clubs, this is the type of paragraph that would generate discussion and make it ideal. Sophie writes, "I'm 36 years old and my husband died 9 months ago, and here I am getting ready to go bowling with a too handsome actor who must have some sort of dark psycho killer secret, because everyone knows all the nice, smart, normal men are married, only the trolls are left." And I think that's probably a fairly common perception, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's sort of that horrible game, musical chairs. I hope kids don't still play that at birthday parties in kindergarten. It fills you with anxiety that there's an uneven number of chairs or people or whatever to go around, and that someone will be left without love without a partner.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm at least here to say that I'm very happily married. I was 40 and my wife was 38 when we met, and I hope I wasn't a troll. We have a wonderful relationship. And Sophie follows her passion in life, which is cooking and baking, and takes the risk of opening a business. And Lolly, based on kind of just a little bit of your background that we talked about, it sounds like you did the same thing in the writing of this novel. You didn't open a bakery or work in a restaurant, but you made the commitment to follow your passion to be a writer, and that ultimately is Sophie's salvation, isn't it?
It is. You know, I think you reach a point in your life, maybe any decade, but for me it was around 40, and for Sophie it's in her late 30s, early 40s, and I think it can particularly happen to English majors, you know, because we end up going down these paths just to earn a living, you know, and pay the rent, and make your car payment. You end up going down a path, and one day you wake up doing something that you aren't particularly interested in, you don't feel particularly good at, and you think, well, what is it that I should or could be doing? That's certainly what I did getting back to writing. I've always been a writer from the time I was in high school, I guess. You know, and I did, as I said, various different English major jobs. But yeah, my 40th birthday was bearing down on me. I thought, yeah, I was going to write a novel before I turned 30. What am I doing?
Yeah.
Together here, at least.
Yeah. But it's hard to do, isn't it?
It is. Novel writing in particular. You know, up until then I just written short stories and essays and feature stories for magazines and papers. But a novel is unwieldy, and it's hard to sort of hold the whole thing in your head at once.
Yeah, I remember when I was talking to your friend Ellen Sussman, and she told me, I believe you two did a reading together, and she said something about how you can't just sit down and write a novel. And then I think she said something to the effect of you two had done a reading together, and then she introduced you, and it was kind of like the appearance almost that that's exactly what you had done, but you had done a lot of writing before that.
Right. Well, what she said is that nobody publishes, I think what she meant was their first novel.
Yeah.
You know, and a first novel usually doesn't do that well. But the thing is, I've obsessively worked on it for so many years, and I've been writing for years. And Ellen, she's a good friend of mine, and she's very good at getting me to just move on, because I'll write chapter one right straight on into the rest home, you know? Stop obsessively going back over and revising. I mean, I can't really separate revising from writing. So yeah, it is my first novel, but
yeah. And Lolly, I think that, like I say on the website, a lot of times people ask me, what good books have you read lately? And the publicity cycle in publishing is bizarre, because all the novels I'm reading right now are coming out in the fall or the spring next year.
Right.
And so that's why I was, when I talked to Miriam Parker, who initially introduced me to your work at Time Warner, and I'd like to say hello to Miriam. She told me about your book, and I was so glad when it came out in trade paperback, scheduling-wise, because I think for a lot of times when people ask me what good books am I reading, the problem is I'm reading a book that's not coming out for 6 months. And,
right.
You know, so
what I love about talking to the independent booksellers, too, is you're right along with them reading all the advanced review copies and stuff, and they're so well-read and such fabulous.
Now, Lolly, and so for book clubs, one of the things about Good Grief is that I think it's an entertaining story. I think it's something that has universal themes that people can talk about. And I can't say that about all the books that of the authors that I interview, because sometimes there might be a little too much violence or sex or language or something. And I'm certainly not a prude, nor are my listeners, but for book clubs, this is something that is pretty safe territory. in addition, and obviously...
That doesn't mean vanilla.
No, not in the least. I would never recommend something that was vanilla.
No, I know.
Yeah. Now, Lolly, I know when I was talking to Miriam, she told me that you have a new novel that I believe, is it being published this summer?
It is. The publication date is August 6th, I think, or 8th. Yeah, anyway, early August, and it's called Happiness Sold Separately, and it's my second novel, completely unrelated to the first one. And I'm finished with it. I was just going over the page proof today, actually.
Well, wonderful, because Miriam mentioned that to me the other day, and I'm excited for you. How about if we do this? How about if we pencil to have you in again maybe in September after the second novel comes out, and we can visit and discuss that novel and get kind of an update on what's going on with your life after the new book hits the bookshelves?
Well, that sounds great. Yeah, I'll be back in my office. Anytime after Labor Day, great. I enjoyed that.
Great. Well, Lolly, thank you so much for taking the time for being on the show today.
Awesome.
Yeah, my guest today has been Lolly Winston. We've been discussing Good Grief, which is available in a very nice trade paperback edition by Warner Books. And we'll touch base with Lolly again down the road when the next book comes out. So, Lolly, thanks again.